and welcome to the Perfect Gentleman podcast. This is episode 35. I am Zach Faulkner-Barfield, and alongside me is James Marwood, the ever charming and ever dapper. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Zach. I'm very well. It's lovely to actually be face-to-face for the first time doing the podcast.
It is the first time we've done this during the podcast. We are live from Pistachio Palace.
Indeed, very swish.
With Mr. Andy Nicol. We're doing it live for you for a bit of fun.
Yes.
A bit of change of scenery.
This is great. We both happened to have a day where we could get together.
Exactly. We'll post some photographs on Instagram about us doing the podcasts and doing them live from the Pistachio Palace.
So what's on the agenda today then, Zach?
Well, it's the start of the month. It's November.
Yes.
November is our politics month.
Splendid.
Some minor election is going on in the
world somewhere. I've seen something about it.
Yeah, seen something about it. And so I thought we'd do a little politics special.
Mm-hmm.
So all the month, there'll be an item about politics all the way through. But we start every month, as we always do, with our gentleman news. So what has caught your eye, James, over the last few weeks?
Well, something I saw that I thought was really interesting. It was an article on 538, which is an American blog. It has all sorts of interesting things on there. But about a chap who'd been scanned to make a suit.
Right.
The way this works is they use a laser or a light scanner to scan and minutely measure your body and then make a suit up that purports to be the perfect suit. And it's not just suits they do. I've seen things like this for jeans and for ladies' wear and those sorts of things. But it was quite interesting. This guy, Chadwick Matlin, has had a suit made for a wedding using this approach, and he seemed really, really happy with it. And the company he used was Alton Lane, who are an American, quite new, along the lines of those suits by mail type places. He seems very happy. Certainly the measurements that it took were very exact. His 15.07-inch collar, for example. And it did adjust for the fact that he had different length arms, as most of us do, which was interesting. So a decent option, I think, but I'd be wary about missing out on the skills of a proper tailor. So I recall the first time I went to a proper tailor, where I went to Graham Brown in London, and we were talking about the sort of suit I would like and started taking my measurements. And he said, so you like to stand with your hands in your pockets. So I'll cut your trousers different. I'm like, I do like to stand with my hands in my pockets. That's true. And he just picked up on that through the way I was standing in the shop. And so he cut my trousers a little bit differently for that and adjusted the jacket slightly. And he also adjusted for the fact that I have quite sloping shoulders and quite broad but quite sloping. So the cut of the suit is slightly different. Whilst a very accurately measured suit like this will fit well, it might not necessarily give you the same advantage that you get with an expert tailor.
I think it doesn't highlight the personality of the person, does it? It's technology, it's fantastic, it's really useful to have that kind of accurate measurement. But as you say, it's missing that, use the French phrase, je ne sais quoi, that a tailor will give you about what pockets you like, the exact length of your jacket, and you maybe like two ticket pockets, or I like always have an internal pen pocket where over my suits because I carry a lot of pens.
That makes sense. But if you don't have a bespoke tailor, a made-to-measure tailor in easy distance, or if your budget doesn't run that way, and they can get very pricey, companies like this, like Alton Brown, Indochino, etc. I've read good things about them. I did buy a suit I took my own measurements and then, well, actually, I got my other half to take some measurements because it's quite hard to measure across your own shoulders, and sent it off and got a suit from a Spanish mail order suit who, I don't recall the name of them now, but they were good. It wasn't brilliant. The quality wasn't great, but the fit was very good for the sort of approach we had. Took it for a few alterations. I think if I had that sort of budget now to buy a suit, which is about the sort of £250, £300 mark, I'd probably do what I would normally advise others to do, which is buy off the rack and get it adjusted. But this idea of getting actually scanned, I think sounds quite interesting. So I might give that a try at some point, just to see how it works.
Yeah, I think we should give it a go. Maybe we'll do a review of that in the future.
Yeah, that would work.
Talking about things that are interesting on the style front, one of the websites that we usually frequent, Business Insider, has given a guide to autumn style, what they should and shouldn't do. Autumn myths busted or something.
Okay,
along those lines.
Debunked. More than myths debunked.
That's the one.
Yes.
So some of them are interesting and some of them I think are highly amusing. One of them was you don't need a new wardrobe for winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty true these days.
One of the things that you often hear about in men's style is this idea of a three-season suit or a three-season outfit, the idea being that it'll see you through probably most of the year other than the hottest months of summer. And I think in somewhere like the UK that has a relatively moderate climate, that can work. In a lot of Europe, that'll work. But having worked in parts of the US, I wouldn't want to wear the same sort of suit that I can get away with in London in the winter in, say, New York or Chicago in the winter, because that's an entirely different level of cold.
Absolutely.
Yes, but I think it's right. You just need a couple of things just for the very coldest days.
Autumn and winter also makes you break out the tweed.
Yes, it was interesting. It was about the back end of October, and I had to go through to meet with my accountant, and I was putting a suit on for that, as you would do, and it was such a miserable grey day, and I got really excited because it was tweeds.
Time for tweed.
Brilliant. It's cold and misty and horrible outside. I'm putting tweed on.
Excellent. And the other thing they pointed out was prints for winter. I don't know about that one. I think I've never been a print fan, so it's not something I would recommend. But
no, I mean, I tend just to wear prints mostly if I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt, which we talked about a few episodes back, or print ties. Obviously, I like those, but I'm not sure. If it's part of your style normally, and there's no reason it shouldn't be, if it's something you like, then I'm sure you can get away with them in winter just as much. The only thing to be wary of is that autumn-winter colour tones are generally a little bit more muted. You tend to have more of the greens and browns, maybe, than the bright yellows or reds. As long as you look good and you feel good, no reason not to.
Absolutely. This is the one I find amusing. Sunglasses are also for winter. Sort of.
Winter sun can be really strong, and yes, especially if you're driving. I keep a pair of sunglasses in my briefcase all the time, and I keep a pair in the car. I think the advice they give about using different colours, so maybe honey brown tortoise shell, and matching your outfit, but I tend to wear brown tortoise shell sunglasses anyway. That's my normal kind of wear all year round. I think sunglasses are essential if you're driving, to be safe. If you're out walking in the winter sun, why not? But not when you don't need them.
Yes, well, that brings us to my favourite point about, unless you're a rock star.
Yes.
Sunglasses indoors, in the dark, just take them off. The amount of times I see people wandering around in sunglasses in, like, the tube on underground.
I tried it just when I sat on the tube, and there was a guy in sunglasses, and he got off, and I was like, what's it? And so I put my sunglasses on, and it was so dark. I wouldn't feel comfortable walking around like that, especially not the tube, where, you know, there's a chance you might fall down under a train track.
And one of the other interesting things they mentioned, we won't go through all the list, was white in winter. The rule is no white after Labor Day. In America,
generally,
that's September. But it's basically saying no white after September. Mm-hmm. I kind of agree with this. I mean, you can wear white in winter. There are some lovely white off-white clothing that you can wear in winter. It's just choosing it correctly and making sure it works with your outfit. And probably white, as we've already said previously in a previous podcast, white in the city is not a good option unless you're willing to wash it all the time.
So that's true. I think one of the things you can take some really good cues on this from is the way a lot of ladies dress in the winter. Things like white or light cream tops, jumpers, scarves, overcoats, things like that. Very white is probably not great in the summer for most of us because we tend to be a bit more pale and pallid. It's probably then going to wash you out a bit. A soft cream or an off-white, something like that, I think can look really good during the summer. Just not the full outfit. Pair it with other stronger but muted colours, and I think you could look really quite good with that.
Exactly. So what else has been caught your eye on the gents news side?
Well, there was something that was quite interesting. I need to be slightly careful on this because we might shade a little bit into talking politics, but it was about knights who are not acting in the way that their title would suggest.
So this is about in the UK when you receive a knighthood or a damehood and you get the title of sir or dame, X, Y or Z, whatever your thing is. And yes, there's been some instances recently of people who have been given knighthoods who have not been behaving as perhaps we would expect someone of that stature to behave.
The examples that have been in the news in the UK recently have been Sir Philip Green, a businessman, owned British Home Stores, which was a very popular and beloved old chain of department stores. They've gone bankrupt and he's walked away with rather a lot of money and a new yacht.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yes. And also Sir Craig Oliver, who was a political advisor, spin doctor, who has been trying to sell his diaries and his books and sort of giving away some of the secrets that he probably shouldn't if he was being strictly ethical. You know, we can talk about the honour system and whether that is right or not, but when you've got people who have been given an honour and recognition for being successful, it's not always just about commercial success or professional success. It brings with it an expectation that you act in a way that is in line with the honour you've been given. For example, Sir Philip Green, now the title he's been given is that of a knight, which you would expect to carry with it an amount of social responsibility and manners and honour. And as the, I can't remember which Joint Select Committee it was, but it was one of the parliamentary committees, really held that he hadn't acted in that way, hadn't acted in line with that. They talked about both the reputation for retail business acumen that he didn't show, but also that he didn't act in a way which was ethically in line with what you'd expect someone who'd been rewarded as a public figure to do. And that's a shame.
For me, it's about the fact that if you've been given an honorific, a title or something, you should have a code of conduct which you need to adhere to maintain that, because that's what you've been given. Otherwise, it devalues the honour for other people in the future. And that's the problem. It becomes, well, I'm just giving it to you because you're a mate or because you contributed a lot of money to our political campaign. Or the whole point about the code of chivalry, which is about having those responsibilities. Being a dame or a knight or any other honorific title should have that code of conduct upheld. And if you break it, you lose it.
Yes. Indeed.
Automatically. No ifs, buts, ooh, we have to go and sign off on it. You haven't behaved in this way. I'm terribly sorry. Off you go. Not off with your head like in the olden days, but yes, off with your honour.
It's interesting. I think it was in the 90s when that process for removing honours was put forward. The Queen, whose honours they are to give, can cancel and annul these. There's no set guidelines. It's all case by case, which I think is a bit of a... There's a trick missed there. I mean, you automatically forfeit it if you go to prison for at least 3 months, as Vicky Price, if you recall her, that she discovered, the Economist, when she took her husband's points for speeding. And so she lost her companionship of the Order of the Bath. It's the forfeiture committee who do it, and it's all secret and it's all quiet. But I think if we're giving people honours and we're recognising them, we need to expect them to behave in line with that, with honour.
As the name dictates.
Indeed. Indeed. Yes.
Moving on, sir. It's a stylish gentleman section.
Yes.
Politician style. I think it's very interesting that it's one of those things we almost take for granted and yet has changed and has influenced and is influencing on people. How style has changed for politics, being dressed and how you're dressed, has changed over the course of time, and what people expect of politicians and that level of formality to informality. I find it's really fascinating that you saw the change happen in the 90s, and Tony Blair basically was one of the, I think, the first of those politicians who took off the tie.
Yes.
Everything before that was very formal. Every minister would be suited and tied, and the tie would match the colour of allegiance of your party, you know, a Labour Party in the UK, you generally have red or those kind of tones. If you're a Conservative, you'd have blue. Bizarrely, in America, it's reversed, but that's...
Yes.
I always find that bizarre, but there we go. In America, it's red for the Republicans and blue for the Democrats. But it started to change with, I think, Tony Blair in that 90s was the first part of that change.
Absolutely, that's
of
true.
Of that culture of we have to be formal, we have to be in a certain way. And now we're down to the point where ties don't generally happen very frequently. Even the President of the United States, Obama, is frequently without tie.
Yes.
Leader of Russia, Mr. Putin, generally goes without a shirt.
Yes, yes, it's been known. But that goes with the tough guy image, I think.
Yeah.
It is interesting. I mean, you can look back to some of the early politicians, for example. I believe it was Keir Hardie, who was famous for turning up to Parliament in work clothes rather than a suit. And that being quite a bone of contention, and that was obviously him showing his very strong working class roots. We can think about guys like Kennedy, who is often probably unfairly blamed for the death of the hat, a standard male attire. But he certainly was the first president, I believe, to not wear a hat to major events. But we have had generally this move towards formality over the last 80, 90 years. And it's interesting that that seems to be manifesting itself at the moment with people... politicians wearing bad suits.
Yes.
Or at least badly fitting suits. I mean, you can talk about, for example, Donald Trump, who always wears a suit for pretty much every public appearance or when he's on TV. And he approaches suits, I think, in a similar way to, if you remember Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian PM, with these extravagant wide lapels, very fine mohairs and wool silk mixers and things like that. Clearly very expensive, probably very well made, but they put forward a certain type of personality, which is this aggressive, brash, I'm rich and I want you to know it, sort of anti-style, if you like.
Yes.
And then you can compare that to the suits that someone like Obama wears. It was quite interesting in the previous American election with John McCain, when they had what's often been called the prawl gap, and it was kind of christened as such in some of the men's style blogs, which is the gap between the shirt collar and the collar of your suit coat, is it stands away from the neck, which is generally a feature of a badly fitting suit. But these suits were being worn deliberately to give that man of the people, not too much care or attention being spent on clothes to suit a particular political agenda, which is interesting. And it's a bit of a shame because it kind of normalises badly fitting suits.
The whole image thing is projecting, I don't care, but actually you do care because you've actually designed yourself to wear those clothes and that style in that way to appeal to a certain market. As our lovely friend Andy, who's at the end of this podcast, was talking about before we went on air, it was the bad knotted ties.
Yes.
He was talking about the yes. ties off to askew or
schoolboy look.
The schoolboy look, yes. Yeah. That's not quite right. Part of me thinks it's a carefully managed image, especially mm-hmm. these days with all the spin doctors and PR people mm-hmm. that run around with them. Just find that little bit of carelessness just quite sad, really.
Yes, it is. You do see this, for example, if you look at, say, a politician like Putin or even Obama, they buy, I believe, their suits from Canali, the Italian suit maker, who make fantastic, wonderful quality handmade suits. But often they kind of dress down, or not Putin, because he probably cares less about what the people think of him, or the views are less in Russia, but in the US, and you see that with some of the British politicians, where they seem to have the nice suits for certain events, but when they're going out on the hustings, or they're going out to speak, or they're going out to be on television, they put on a cheaper, less well-fitting suit, which is just pretense of a different kind.
Yeah, part of me wants to go back into that sort of bit with Benjamin Disraeli, who was known for being flamboyant
yes.
and extravagant dresser in Parliament, and actually was chastised for mm-hmm. his flamboyance and excessive dressing by Her Majesty Queen Victoria at the time as well.
Chukwuemeka, when he was being considered as a potential candidate for leadership of the Labour Party, someone who might put himself forward, you know, there was a lot of play was made of the fact that he buys Oswald Bolting suits, which are expensive and stylish and probably a bit too London trendy for the voters he was going for, which is a shame because Oswald Bolting suits are fantastic, especially if you're tall and slim and quite handsome as Mr. Obama is. You can't sell that, I think, as easily to voters as somebody who looks like they buy their suit from the Men's Warehouse or Burton's.
Do we want our politicians to dress well? Because they're a brand image for the country as well. I think that's the other thing. I think we forget that they appear on television a lot and we want them to be the projected image of the face of the country.
Well, look at Justin Trudeau, who wears really good suits, dresses really well. And he does that without compromising his image. He's not being ostentatious in how well-dressed he is. He's just really well-dressed, or not a politician, but someone I often talk about as being the best-dressed royal is Prince Philip, because you never notice his suits.
Yes.
Unless you're looking, you never notice them. His suits just are sober, perfectly cut, perfectly well-fitting, but they're cut and designed in such a way that they just blend into the background.
And that's probably the way it should be.
I think so.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Justin Trudeau in a future podcast.
Yes.
I know he's one of our most talked about politicians for the political issue. And
yes.
Leah Morrigan is going to talk a little about him later in the podcast. So moving on from style, the next thing about politics, which is always fascinating, mm-hmm. and one of the things that personally I'm
yes.
passionate about, is body language.
Yes, and it's very important. I remember going into my early days learning to be a manager and being told that whole thing about communication being 10% what you say, 20% how you say it, and 70% what your body language is. And I don't know that those percentages are necessarily true, but being able to use good body language is a really important part of being an effective communicator.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what's really interesting is the figures are bandied about. I can go through the study and all that sort of stuff, but I won't bore you with that. But basically, in general, yes, the majority of our communication is nonverbal. So how we stand, how we move, how we act, what our body says about us, how our eyes move and all that sort of thing is basics of communication. Then words and tonality and all that sort of stuff say other things as well. And what's fascinating is how the science of that has changed mm-hmm. and how politicians have used that. Favorite example of that is the inoffensive finger point.
Yes, you've been talking about this earlier. Remind me what it is.
Generally, you know, you have the pointing finger, the wagging finger, the teacher's wagging finger, your forefinger out and wagging and pointing at you to emphasize points, but also to sort of say, naughty James.
Yes, I get this quite a bit at home, to be fair. The Duchess has a very good wagging finger.
Well, politicians, because that's offensive,
mm-hmm.
but they want to emphasize points. And so what happens is you bend the knuckle. So you make your fist as you would do with a finger point, mm-hmm. and then you bend the finger down. So basically your knuckle is the only thing going. You're pointing with a knuckle
okay,
to emphasise the point.
Yep.
And that becomes inoffensive.
Yes, I can see that. I can see you do it in front of me. There's not a big wacky finger.
Just a slightly protruded knuckle.
Yes.
It's like if you're punching and you put your knuckle out. That's
yes,
basically
yes.
what you're doing. Again, in the 90s, Tony Blair was one of the great exponents of this. He was aware of this, or should I say probably certain spin doctors that he might have worked with were aware of this. And he changed the body language. He went from the finger point to the inoffensive finger point to emphasise points. And of course, it would go on the words. So the body language there, it's emphasising the word with the inoffensive finger point. And that's a great example of how body language has changed, but also how it's been adapted for politics to change the way we perceive people.
One of the things that I've noticed a few times when I'm dealing with or when I'm watching guys who speak well, and especially some of the good politicians who speak well, or people in business or presenters, is the way that they use their body language to punctuate and intensify the message that they're giving. So sometimes with a finger, or with Donald Trump likes to point your finger. You
know. Donald Trump has broken all the politics body language rules.
Yes, indeed. Then you also have somebody like Ken Robinson. So Ken Robinson, who gave, I think, which is probably still the most successful, most watched TED Talk, and his body language is fantastic, and it's not especially animated. He's not striding around the stage like, say, Tony Robbins would do. Instead, he's standing quite still, but emphasising just with little movements of his arms, little movements of his hands, in a way that gives that quiet confidence to what he's saying, which I find very compelling.
Yes, it's interesting. So when you give presentations, I know a lot about this, I've studied about this, you can do one of two things. So you move, as you say, to emphasise points, mm-hmm. or the greatest power is to stand still. If you can manage it, and it's difficult and it takes practice, when you present anything, is to maintain almost complete stillness until you want to emphasize a point.
I see.
And then you move your hands or your mm-hmm. arms to emphasize the point. Because if you're still, all they're doing is listening to you. And then what you need to do is just emphasize the point with one gesture. It's almost like dance. It's kind yes. of that stillness is harder to do, but stillness is emphasizing because all you're doing is concentrating on yes. the voice, the one thing that you're making them concentrate on.
Yes.
So that is the power of body language in that sense, mm-hmm. is presenting, or you move across. And there's far too long on this podcast for it to explain why you move and the psychology of yeah. that. But that kind of thing of stillness mm-hmm. is power.
That makes perfect sense. And if I'm thinking about people who are very good speakers, like Barack Obama, for example, you know, he often is quite still, but then when he wants to change the mood, he'll lean forward slightly or stand up straighter. Or when he's doing his slightly comedy turns, you know, he'll tilt himself slightly sideways. And that works incredibly well. I was watching one of his videos, and I knew we were going to be talking about this. He was doing his White House Correspondents' Dinner, and he has this great way where he's giving his traditional slightly straight speech, and then he turns slightly to one side, rests his arm on the lectern, and lets rip with a zinger. It's just that combination of timing and of speech and of the little change in his facial expression, and that little lean forward makes you lean in as well. So you're kind of expecting something to come, and then when it comes, it's boom. And he is a surprisingly funny man for a politician.
He is surprisingly funny for a politician. The other thing about politics and also body language, which is fantastic and fascinating, is the handshake.
Yes.
So if you watch politicians when they meet each other, then they handshake each other. You watch the dominance.
Yes.
And there's a lot of politicians, who shan't name them, who try to upstage their opponents yes. with the handshake. Because what you don't want to do is, generally, you're taking a photo call.
Mm-hmm.
So you go for the handshake. And what you don't want to do as the other politician mm-hmm. is to cross your hand across your body. You're basically turning away from mm-hmm. the camera. So if you watch politicians, they have this weird handshake where they're both trying to face the camera and shake hands at the same time.
Yep.
And it's this very weird body posture. They don't want to turn away from the camera
yes.
and tilt their body so their face is not front mm-hmm. onto the camera. And what some people will try and do is make them turn. So they bring their hand further away. Or yeah. It's lovely to watch those gestures of power plays between politicians
yeah.
and the handshake. And handshakes are really interesting things because they have certain cultural significance. I think mm-hmm. we've talked about them before, but that thing about in Western Europe, it should be a firm handshake with eye contact, mm-hmm. but not too firm so you're crushing someone's knuckles. In Asian cultures and Indian cultures, the handshake needs to be soft and mm-hmm. gentle and almost to the point of feather-like contact. But again, there's that power play in handshakes about whether your hand's on top and below. And we were joking before we came on with Andy and the strange handshakes
yes.
that we've come across.
It is one of these things that in politics, in business, in life, when you're looking to make impressions, that first impression, the body language really matters. And a good handshake is one of the ways to do that, both with the person you're shaking hands with, but also with the people who see it. And obviously there's the silly dance you mentioned about the, you know, not twisting the body, but being able to give a good culturally appropriate handshake is important. I've tripped up before in business with giving a firm handshake when I was in India to a guy I was meeting who wasn't used to working with Westerners, and it clearly put him off his stride. If I'd been going in to do some hard-nosed negotiation, not really my style, but I might have wanted to use that. But given that I was looking to build a quick and effective working relationship, it was a misstep. And so knowing those rules ahead of time is really useful.
But I suggest our listeners out there watch a few videos of politicians meeting and see all that power play, because it's hilarious to watch. It's a bit one of the body language experts did a montage of all the different handshakes and all the different power plays. And it's great when you watch like a G8 conference or a G20 conference and they're all body posturing, manoeuvring to get in the right position. And Putin's a classic at that, trying to maneuver his body so he's always in the primary body position.
Some of the examples I've seen with Putin of trying to force his hand on top, or bulking his chest up if he's face on with somebody so he looks larger, is quite fun. And then you compare that to somebody like the Queen, who does none of those tricks and still manages to be the centre of attention and to have perfect poise.
Well, Her Majesty is Her Majesty, and that's all we can say about
that. Indeed. Well, she's been doing it for a very long time.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much for listening to us today, live from the Pistachio Palace. We are always happy to hear from you. Please drop us a line about your body language experiences, your style experiences of the politicians, or some gentlemanly news. We'd like to hear from you. If you've got some gentlemanly news that you'd like us to talk about on next month's podcast, then please drop us a line. It's enquiries@theperfectgentleman.tv, or you can find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, we're there. James and I are always on hand to respond, keep you enlightened and entertained. But thank you very much for listening to us. James, it's been a pleasure.
As always, Zach, really good fun. Let's speak again soon.
Speak again soon. Bye.
This podcast is brought to you by The Perfect Gentleman Group Limited and was edited by Andy Nicol at the Pistachio Palace.